Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Perspective on Legal Frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
Well, we got back in the recording studio.
Yep. It took a while. We're still battling that illness of yours.
I know. I think this was like a different version, though. This one was more of a stomach slash, well, let's just say some stomach issues.
Yeah, let's not go into too much detail. TMI, TMI.
But it had me out of action for like 4 or 5 days.
We're in too much action.
Well, yeah, however you want to put it. Yeah, it was not pleasant. So,
well, just stay on your side of the table there and we'll be all right. I don't need any of those things. I'm fixing to go out of town, so I don't need any of that.
I've been loaded up on Pedialyte, toast, yogurt, and the occasional chicken noodle broth if I was feeling rather saucy.
You sound like a baby.
Yeah, I felt like
a baby. That's what you feed babies.
I felt like a baby. So, but I was feeling better last night and I was ready finally for some solid food and I ordered a steak sandwich from Giovanni's.
Did that react all right?
Yeah. It tasted pretty good.
Well, good.
I figured a steak sandwich, I was kind of, their steak sandwich is not very greasy and it's kind of like a lot of bread and so.
Yeah, you can rely on Giovanni's. They're good.
That's true. But yeah, it feels good to be recording again.
I haven't seen a baby with that much beard before. That would be a weird looking baby.
Come see the bearded baby. $5. Well, I have a couple of interesting updates from some of the prior things we've talked about.
Update time.
The first is about our friend Bobby Kraft.
Oh, yeah. Mr. Kraft. He's still battling his criminal activity there.
That's right. I just wanted to call him Bobby for some reason. I don't know why.
Bob Kraft. Robert Kraft. Just depends on.
Well, it's like, you know, Robert De Niro. It's like, oh, my buddy, Bobby De Niro, you know. Yeah. It makes you sound like you're more friends with him or something.
Yeah, that's
like that.
Right. So. Yeah, we're on the same level.
Well, I don't want to be on this. I don't want to be on the same level as Robert Kraft. Thank you very much. But anyway, his lawyers have filed a new motion to suppress in court.
Yeah, they probably want to suppress that film. That would be the main thing. Now, you don't want that video to come out.
No, I'm sure it's probably pretty shocking. But anyway, part of the reason that they've gone ahead and filed it, and this is what they outlined in their motion, which is available online. It said that the law enforcement didn't try less invasive methods of investigation first, which is generally, that's one of the prerequisites you have to show before getting like a warrant or some sort of wiretap like that.
Mm-hmm.
That the low-level offenses involved make invasive recording methods categorically unnecessary and inappropriate. That the warrant didn't hew to adequate minimization procedures. According to the motion, the warrant provided no instructions for the video monitors to guide them as to when to stop recording, instead authorizing them to record everything that occurred while the cameras were on. And Florida law doesn't really allow wiretapping for investigating prostitution, they said. And the warrant was issued based on misstatements by law enforcement.
Yeah, one of the things I heard is that, you know, it says not for prostitution. Well, the prosecution's defense would be, we didn't do it for that. We did it for human trafficking. But now they're coming out and saying there was really no evidence of human trafficking.
Really?
That it was strictly a prostitution thing. Now, that's what the defense is contending. So,
you mean the state, you mean?
The state's contending there was human trafficking. The defense, is saying, yeah, that there wasn't any signs of human trafficking. It was all strictly just a prostitution sting.
Like these were consensual prostitutes.
Yes, that's what they're contending. Like now, who's right? Who knows? They're all telling their side.
Yeah. Well, they did go ahead and file a motion to, on the back of the motion to suppress, they filed a motion for a protective order as well from the court asking the, basically, so no one has access to this public record. Because Florida has very open, what they call sunshine laws, where everything mm-hmm. is public record, everyone can get access to it, you just file a request for it. Kind of like the Freedom of Information Act, but even more so, I think.
Yeah, and there's always leakers. Once this thing gets leaked to the internet, that's it. Katie, bar the door.
There's some sort of Robert Kraft leaking joke in there, but I'm not going to get into it.
You're still under medication and stuff, so it's hard to get into. Huh?
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, they're trying everything they can to keep this out of court, obviously, because they don't want it to get out there. You know, and the other thing I was thinking about too is the interesting thing for Robert Kraft is even if he wins this criminal case and is, you know, found not guilty or exonerated or charges dismissed or all this, I mean, he still might be facing some pretty hefty sanctions from
the NFL.
The NFL,
yeah.
Because they don't really go by whatever the criminal investigation is.
Right.
I think we talked about it a little bit. I mean, there have been players who have been found not guilty of certain things, but still face suspension on it.
Right. I mean, we're just talking about semantics here. We know that he did what he did. Everybody knows that he did what he did. The question is he going to be able to get off on some type of technicality or wrong way they did something or something like that? But the fact remains, he still did what he did. Now, does the NFL take action against him for that?
Yeah, it'd be an interesting thing. And, you know, they probably need to hold the owners to a higher standard, I would think. I mean, that's who I think you need to make an example of. I mean,
sure.
That if you don't hold the owners to a higher example, I mean, what does that set for the players?
The whole thing falls apart from there. It starts unraveling.
It's a slippery slope.
That's right.
So we'll keep following that and figure out what's going on with that. It's kind of interesting story given the people involved, I guess.
Yeah, and I guess they probably have plenty of oral arguments.
Maybe so. I just hope they keep it brief. Now, the other update is from the U.S. Supreme Court. It has way less innuendo.
Oh, darn.
Yeah. But recently, the Supreme Court ruled last Thursday night to stop the execution of a Buddhist inmate in Texas who was not allowed to have a spiritual advisor by his side at the time of execution. So basically what this inmate did in Texas, this Buddhist inmate, he filed a motion, I guess, to stay or whatever with the Supreme Court, some sort of emergency motion to make them stop, saying his constitutional rights were being violated because he wasn't able to have his spiritual advisor of his choice there.
Well, they find any other Buddhists in Texas to come there?
No, there was somebody available, I guess, but it's just they wouldn't allow that person in the room with him.
Hmm.
So,
but they would have let a priest in or something?
They would have let in some sort of Christian person there. And I think also in Texas they allow Muslim imams as well.
Hmm.
But here's the interesting thing is last month, under almost identical situation in Alabama, a Muslim inmate filed a very similar motion, and because basically Alabama only allowed a Christian spiritual advisor or whatever, and this guy wanted his imam there, his Muslim spiritual advisor.
Yeah.
And the Supreme Court basically said, no, we're going to let the execution go forward.
Huh.
So when you're looking at these two decisions, they seem very diametrically opposed as far as what's going on here.
Sure does.
Now, there's kind of different thought processes. Now, the reason it seems that Justice Kavanaugh has changed his mind about it, which I think is probably a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason he gave in the opinion is basically because he said that the inmate in Texas filed his brief and his motion and everything more timely, whereas the inmate in Alabama did not. And that's what he was basing his decision on. Like, well, the one guy was timely, the other guy wasn't, and that's why this is different.
The guy in Alabama, they like had their hand on the switch, and he said, wait a minute, I've decided I'm Muslim, yeah, and I need a Muslim guy here.
But at least according to this one article I read in the Washington Post says that that's actually not true if you look at the circumstances, that basically the rules in Alabama were almost kind of like a secret policy that this guy didn't know about until 2 weeks before his execution.
Oh.
And so basically he filed it almost immediately when he found out about it, but it wasn't like a written published policy that was out there. So he filed it without delay as far as when he was aware of the notice of it, which, you know, I think that's all you can do for the guy. He didn't know.
Yeah.
Whereas actually the guy in Texas, the Buddhist, when he filed his, this was like a written policy that you were only allowed to have either a Christian or a Muslim spiritual advisor there.
Mm-hmm.
And basically he didn't file his until later on. Now, I mean, it was more than 2 weeks, but it was still later on down the road. So you can kind of look at that argument and think that, well, maybe that doesn't make much sense, that maybe that really wasn't the reason why that Kavanaugh changed his mind, but maybe that's just what he was trying to use as the reason why he did it. But the other interesting thing is that possibly there was a very strong dissent in the Alabama case, the one with the Muslim who was allowed to be put to death. And that was basically a 5-4 type vote. I mean, it was very close.
Mm-hmm.
And the dissent in the Alabama case was written by Justice Kagan, and they declared that what the decision was in the Alabama case was profoundly wrong, and that basically the treatment goes against the Establishment Clause's core principle of denominational neutrality, which I tend to agree with. I think if you're saying basically you're allowed to have one spiritual advisor there from some sort of religion, you're entitled to have a spiritual advisor there from any religion. You can't dictate what it is.
Sure. I mean, you can't come up with it at the last minute just as a way to delay things, but if you file it properly and ahead of time, then yeah, there's no reason why they shouldn't comply with that.
There's a law professor at George Mason University, in Ilya Soman, and she was quoted as saying that basically she thinks that the most logical explanation for the difference in decision is that the court was really surprised by the barrage of the criticism it received from both the left and the right, and that the justice belatedly realized they had made a mistake, and not just any mistake, the one that inflicted real damage on their and the court's reputations.
Hmm.
That's what she wrote in a blog. So this might be one of those cases where they made one decision and didn't think much of it, and then there was such public outcry from it, even though, you know,
they rethought their positions.
Yeah, even though they're in tenured positions, they mm-hmm. still thought, wait a second, there's this much outcry.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we got it wrong.
Maybe we overlooked something.
Yeah, and I don't have a problem with that. And I don't have a problem with them saying, hey, we got it wrong. I don't think they'd ever do that.
Mm-hmm.
I think instead they'll say, well, this guy was more timely. The other guy wasn't.
Yeah.
I think they'll use that as an excuse maybe, but I do think that maybe they got it wrong and they were kind of thinking, geez, we better fix this.
Yeah, well, you'd think that shouldn't have just turned around and been 5-4 because one person switched for the next one, though.
Yeah.
You'd think a few more would have come on over to the light.
Oh, I don't know what the actual vote was on the next one. I was just saying the other one was 5-4.
Oh, okay.
We know that Kavanaugh changed because he basically wrote his opinion as to why this was different. He was trying to distinguish it.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, there's a couple different updates from the legal world out there. I've been reading these things because I've been couch bound.
Well, that's good. I'm glad you have time to catch up on your reading. Some of us have to work for a living.
I'm using up sick days at an alarming rate this month.
Uh-oh.
So.
Well, so you might have to have somebody, you know, vouch for you on that. You may even have to get somebody to notarize a medical certificate for you or something.
I may have to do that just the same. Always, it got me wondering, what is a notary, Tommy?
Well, I thought maybe you could answer that. How's that for a segue?
Well, essentially, what a notary is that they are a person, and this is at least in the modern era. I think you're going to talk a little about the history of them.
And this is what our topic is for today. we didn't just stumble into this.
It was such a seamless segue.
Well, I know, but I was afraid we'd catch people off guard. They'd keep waiting for what the real topic is, and we slipped it in on them. It was so smooth.
Well, I think usually they're always waiting for what the real topic is. They're kind of confused about it.
And then they hear us closing at the end and say, darn, I missed it again.
Yeah, what were those two knuckleheads talking about?
What did they say?
It's like, legal, Bruce, what? No, what? What are they talking about? So the job of a notary, at least in the modern era, is to verify that the person signing something is essentially the person that they say they are. That's a real basic explanation of it. Usually the person has to show like a driver's license or some other state-issued valid ID. So basically, if you hear somebody say that they have to do like an affidavit, so basically mm-hmm. they would type out something and then sign it and have a notary notarize it. That's basically just a signed notarized statement, and the notary is simply attesting that the person who signed this statement is the person who they say they are.
Do we ever really know who someone is, though? Can we ever really know?
I don't know. This is getting in some deep water here. What is knowing?
That's right. And do we really know someone's mind or their soul or what?
Well, at least according to their IDs, we know who they are, and that's good enough for the court system.
Okay. Yeah, and the TSA.
Yeah. So another thing that people notarize oftentimes are contracts, mm-hmm. wills. Sometimes people notarize letters, although I never really understand why they do that. It seems like kind of a extra step on something you don't really need, but people do it nonetheless.
Financial documents.
Yeah, financial documents. Different reports you submit to the state or the federal government might have to be notarized, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I know like my application for the Florida Bar and the West Virginia Bar and I think law school and things like that had to be notarized. So basically you have to, and that's probably more because of the, you're being truthful to it. You hereby attest that you're being truthful to the document and whatever you're submitting. But yeah, so a lot of different things have to be notarized.
They might need to add notary to college admission things based on the current scandal, huh? People taking tests for people and getting scholarships for things they've never participated in and stuff like that.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, I think that, essentially when somebody checks in to take a test, like an SAT or things like that, they check their IDs, and that's almost kind of a form of notarization, I guess, essentially, because you're basically testing the person's ID requirements to say who they say they are.
Mm-hmm.
Not like biometrics or anything like that, just by their
eye scan.
Yeah. There's not any kind of one federal requirement to be a notary. Basically, each state has their own different requirements to become a notary. And just because you're a notary in one state doesn't necessarily mean you can notarize something in a different state. But it does mean that if something is legally notarized in one state, that another state will give full faith and credit to that notarized thing from the other state. Okay. That's just kind of how that works. All lawyers are not notaries. Some people kind of think that that's the thing. I have been a notary in the past, but I'm not now. I let it expire. But just because you're a lawyer does not mean you're a notary or anything like that.
Right.
At the courthouse, usually people that are the clerks, whenever you file things, they're usually notaries because they have to take oaths and things like that when people file things. Additionally, and this is where a lot of people get things notarized and they might not realize it, you can go to your bank and get things notarized. They usually have a notary there at the bank, and that's kind of a cheap, free way to do it, especially because if you have an account there, that's one of the services they usually provide for you for free.
Yeah, so I used to work at a bank, and I remember there was a lady there that was a notary, and whenever we needed something notarized, we'd run to her. Hey, can you notarize this for me? A lot of times it was like a $5 fee or something like that, but she would waive it for us fellow employees.
Yeah, well, it's free for almost every time I've gone to the bank to do it.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, maybe they changed that. Used to be. Also, like the UPS office around here, they would have a notary. The UPS store.
Right.
They would have a notary where you had to have things notarized that you sent in and stuff, and they would notarize it for you.
Yeah, they definitely.
And they charge you a fee.
They definitely charge a fee there.
Libraries sometimes have notaries.
You never know. They just pop up everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. I thought it was a real sacred thing, but when they had one at the public library, I thought, well, it can't be too sacred.
The biblioteca?
Yeah, whatever that is.
Spanish for library.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll remember that if I'm in Spain.
La biblioteca.
All right.
It's one of my favorite Spanish words. Probably everybody's favorite Spanish word, too.
Everybody's?
Yeah, it just rolls off the tongue.
Mine is margarita. It rolls down the tongue.
Pass the gums through the tongue. Look out stomach. Here it comes. Now, the procedures, like I said, vary from state to state, but here are the general kind of steps to become a notary. Well, first of all, you have to make sure you meet all the state's qualifications. That could mean not having a felony conviction, not having a misdemeanor conviction for fraud or dishonesty, just different things. It varies state by state.
Not being currently drunk or on drugs.
That's true. You have to generally complete and submit an application. There's going to be some sort of filing fee. There may be some sort of training or education that you have to go through, like a test. You may pass a state-administered exam. You generally have to have some sort of fingerprinting or background check. Well, not every state does it, but most of them do. You have to get some sort of commission from the state showing that you are a notary. And you have to get a surety bond in some states.
Hmm.
So basically, you have to be a bonded notary to make sure that, you know, if you screw things up, somebody can come after your bond. You have to file everything with the state to make sure you have all your different ducks in a row. And the most important thing, you have to have a notary stamp.
Yeah. How do you get one of those? You just order it from like Amazon?
Yeah, you can order it from anywhere.
Really?
Yeah. Now, basically, the easiest way to do this, there are all these different online services that you go to if you want to become a notary. And essentially, all you do is you go and, well, in Florida, I've only done it in Florida. I've never done it in West Virginia. But in Florida, I had to go take a test. I had to take a class online. I had to take a test. I had to pay a fee. And the same company that does the test and all that, they go ahead and administer your bond as well. So you get a bond. And then they send you a stamp. And my company I went through, I was notarizing so much stuff, I actually broke my stamp and told them that I broke it. They sent me a new one for free.
Wow, that's pretty good.
I was like, great service.
Yeah, it's guaranteed for life.
Now, to become a notary in West Virginia, though, it's not quite as onerous. Or is that onerous?
Onerous.
Yeah, onerous, less onerous, onerous.
He has to be less honest. That's why it's not so onerous.
Maybe so. But to become a notary in West Virginia, you have to be at least 18. You have to be a citizen or permanent legal resident of the U.S. You have to be a resident of West Virginia or have a place of employment or practice in West Virginia. You have to be able to read and write English, have a high school diploma.
Well, that eliminates most.
A high school diploma?
The read and write English.
A high school diploma might, too. Not have a conviction for any felony or a crime involving fraud, dishonesty, or deceit, or be disqualified to receive a commission pursuant to West Virginia Code 39421.
And what does that code incur? Is that like you're a person of malfeasance and bad character, and therefore they don't want you being a representative of this very fine dignitary service?
Basically, it is if you fail to comply with this article, and if you are fraudulent, dishonest, or deceitful, misstatement, or omission in the application for the commission, so basically you lie on your application, a finding or a liability against the notary in any legal proceeding or disciplinary action based on the applicant's or notary's public fraud, dishonesty, or deceit, failure by the notary to discharge any duty required by a notary public, use of false or misleading advertising, violation of the notary public rule of the Secretary of State regarding notary public, denial, refusal, renew, or revocation, suspending, conditioning of any notary public commission in another state, failure of the notary public to maintain assurances as provided in Section D, so basically failure to file your annual thing saying you're in compliance. Here's one, charging more than the maximum fee specified in this section, and failing to notify of an address or name change or something along those lines. So basically what it is it's all based pretty much upon fraud.
So if you falsely apply for this, where you're applying for something to attest to other peaceful people's honesty, that looks pretty bad.
Well, we got a problem with that. So, but the interesting thing is in West Virginia, there's no need to have a bond. You don't have to have a bond to be a notary, which I don't like that as much. I think you need to have a bond because that way, if you do screw up, then there's some sort of
penalty.
There's somebody out there who can kind of recover.
Is that like a damage deposit, the bond?
Kind of, a little bit.
Yeah.
And there's no course required in West Virginia, so basically you just fill out the application and do it.
Yeehaw, here I come.
Yeah.
I'm going to be me a notary.
You're not required to keep a notary journal, which basically a lot of times people, what they do is every time they notarize something, they write down.
The guy at the UPS store would do that.
Yeah.
He'd put down my name, and I had to sign in the book.
Right.
And he'd put down the date, and I don't know if he put down what it was or something, but I remember having a book. And
probably the kind of ID you had.
That could
be, write down West Virginia driver's license number, blah, 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 blah.
Right. Yeah, I think that's right.
But that's kind of an important thing, I think, because that keeps the records clear.
Mm-hmm. If somebody claimed you notarized something and you didn't, well, let me refer to the journal. The journal says you never came to my place.
Yeah, I've actually, unfortunately, come across a couple unsavory notaries recently here in West Virginia.
Unsavory notaries?
Yes.
Sound like that's something a cannibal would say, like they didn't taste good.
Well, I don't know. Hopefully the legal system will eat them up. I'm not concerned about it.
They must have been clowns. They tasted funny.
Now, one of the things a notary can do in Florida, which is kind of interesting, is they can marry somebody.
Well, anybody can marry anybody.
Well, it differs state by state. But in order to be to marry somebody in Florida, you have to be a notary.
You have to be a notary to get married?
No, you have to be able to notarize the document to have somebody be married. So,
I thought you meant to get married. You had to be a notary.
Nope.
You just to marry two other people.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. We just split hairs there.
Well, I tell you what. When I found out that I could get my certificate over the internet to perform a marriage for someone, which shall remain nameless, I found out just how loose those laws are when they give one to me.
Loosey-goosey.
And I could go around marrying people willy-dilly. That's ridiculous.
My favorite one I saw was where you could become some sort of pastor or religious figurehead in the Big Lebowski Church.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Because the dude abides.
The dude abides. I want to get that big wall painting, that three-section wall painting thing that they had or saw on Facebook.
Oh, with the different pictures?
Well, it was just a dude, but it was like
in different colors.
Three pictures. Yeah, in different colors. I wanted to get that. That looks cool.
Now, I mentioned something about appropriate fees in West Virginia.
And here are the appropriate fees. To take an acknowledgement, it's $5. Administer an oath, $5. Take a verification, $5. Witness or attest a signature, $5. Certify or attest a copy,
$5.
Well, that's where that $5 came from. Remember I said that when we first started talking about it?
Yeah.
And I said $5. Every time I've got anything notarized or when the lady at the bank would do it, it'd be $5. Yeah. But she would waive that for us if we were fellow employees. But I guess at the UPS store, they'd always charge me $5. I forget what. There were several times we had to go there and sign things or have things signed as a notary for stuff. I don't remember what it was.
I don't know how, but sometimes people would call my office in Florida and say, hey, are you a notary? Like, yeah, I'm a notary. Well, can you notarize something for me? It's like, well, I don't really notarize. I'm not really a notary.
Public notary.
Yeah, I mean, I notarize things for my clients and things like that, but I'm not a public notary. He's like, oh, well, I'm kind of in a pinch. I need this notarized, blah, blah, blah.
I'll give you $5.
Yeah, I'll give you $5. And I'm like, just come in. And then sometimes they'd try to give me $5, and I'd usually be like, no, just that's fine.
$5 is an insult to my craft.
Well, no, because it's like, I'm not really a notary. I do that as for my clients. You know, and I don't want to charge you $5 for it. I mean, just, hey, I'll tell you what, if you need a lawyer in the future, come see me and just remember I waived $5 for this notary fee.
You got a $5 coupon there.
Yeah, there you go. I'll give you $5 off the next retainer you come in for. But yeah, so it's kind of interesting. But I would sometimes notarize people's things for them. A lot of times I do it for estate planning documents like wills and things such as that. That's usually where you do it most as an attorney probably. I guess and also in different closings for contracts and whatnot.
Do the notary stamps vary state by state, or does it pretty much the same other than just your name or whatever?
I mean, they do vary a bit state by state about what they're supposed to say on it. But generally what they have to say on it is essentially the
date range that you're...
Well, they have to have like some sort of seal on it, and they usually say the words notary public. They'll say the state. They'll say who the notary's name is, and they'll say the time, basically whenever their notary stamp expires, because that's one important thing. So it's important to look at all this stuff too. I've actually been able to invalidate a notary stamp on something because they notarized it on their stamp after their thing had expired.
Well, that's not good.
No, so that was kind of a nice catch.
Yeah.
I like being a stickler for the rules. Like, oh, this here is not notarized. This notary stamped it after their thing expired.
Oh, well, don't be so technical.
Yeah.
If we knew what he intended.
Yeah. Wrong. I'm going to be real technical.
Four corners, dude. Four corners.
Yeah. Tell it to the judge. Yeah, so there's, you know, kind of interesting things about different notary type stuff. The notary also has some different liabilities too in West Virginia, which is kind of interesting. And they're basically liable for any kind of misconduct that they might do. So, and also the employer is also liable for a notary officials for their misconduct too. Like if they do it.
Like if they were notarizing things that weren't factual?
Pretty much, yeah. So essentially.
But not like if they went out after hours and got in a bar fight or something like that. They're not responsible for that, right?
And then they went out into a bar fight and then basically took the notary stamp and started beating somebody with it.
Well,
certify this.
Stamp it all over somebody's face.
You're going to expire right now. My stamp doesn't expire till next week, but you're expiring now.
I'm fixing to notarize your ass.
No, like basically official misconduct, which relates to their discharging of the notary public duties.
Okay. The other duties are okay. Like Robert Kraft, if he were a notary, he couldn't be fined for violating his notary jobs by his massage activities.
Probably not, no. Now, I mean, if it was a felony, then maybe. So.
Okay.
Fraud or dishonesty would be like if you're, that's the misdemeanor type things. But that's basically like writing bad checks or something like that.
Wire fraud.
Yeah, wire fraud. There you go. There also can be criminal repercussions for being a malfeasant notary as well.
A malfeasant notary?
Or a misfeasant notary. Yeah. It's generally only up to a misdemeanor, though, in West Virginia. It just depends on how much you are fined. And it can be up to a year in prison, like any misdemeanor for the most part. But, yeah, there's some criminal things, too. So, basically, if you notarize something you're not supposed to or try to forge a document, there's going to be some pretty hefty penalties for it. I mean, it's a criminal act. So it's not just kind of, well, hey, you know, old Cletus over there, he's just all willy-nilly with his notary stamp.
Oh, he was just kidding.
It was just Josh.
He didn't think anybody'd fall for that.
Yeah. No, that's going to be a criminal.
You better take your notary responsibilities seriously, dude.
It is. I mean, it actually is a very serious thing if you think about it, because you're basically helping somebody attest that something is true.
So somebody is who they are.
Yeah, so you're putting your word on the line, and you have an official duty to do that.
Somebody else could forge something, and then you notarize it that it was John Doe when it was really Bill Smith, and you notarize it, and now we got a real legal thing to handle there.
Yeah, I mean, you can basically steal somebody's
property
or cars and
wife,
maybe, I don't know.
He signed her over to me. Look right here.
I don't think it works like that.
So, want her in a poker game.
You might be getting Robert Kraft territory there, Tommy. it's a pretty serious thing if you think about it. And you gotta walk the straight and narrow as a notary.
That's right. So they better only be honest people applying. Need not apply if you're not honest.
And the other thing people always ask about is like, well, I got to send a letter to somebody. Should I have it notarized? Well, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah. I mean, unless it's something legal or, you know.
Well, even if it's legal, if you send the letter to somebody basically saying like, say it's like a landlord-tenant type thing, and you are saying, I'm going to terminate your lease because of this, that, and the other. I'm terminating this lease because of this, that, and the other. Unless the West Virginia code or the state code or statute says it has to be notarized, there's no need to do that.
No, because you're better off sending it registered mail just so that you have a receipt where they sign for it to show they got it.
Well, now most places do require that. They tell you have to send it certified because that shows that they got it.
Yeah.
But I mean, as far as it just being notarized, no, I mean, it's pretty easy to believe. I mean, you're the landlord, so we would believe that you are the person who would say that. Mm-hmm. There's no need to really notarize that and make it official. So
right.
It's kind of interesting. People kind of have a misconception, I think, sometimes about the importance of a notary stamp or what it's actually for.
That makes it more legal or more threatening or something.
Yeah. Oh, it's notarized. This must be serious.
Well, I'm going to take this serious. It's got a notary stamp on it. We all know about notaries.
I always wanted to have one of those wax embossers.
Yeah.
With like a signet ring or something. I know.
That would be cool.
Yeah, you know, that I would take notice if that came through the mail.
And all my documents would be rolled up in a scroll and sealed with that. Because scrolls are much more important than a letter.
Possibly so.
They have much more important information.
I always noticed in Law and Order, and I guess they're usually set in like New York, but all their motions and things come in a blue thing trifolded. I don't know, maybe that's how they do it in New York, but I've never seen a motion come in a blue trifolded thing that I get handed. Oh, great. They're moving to suppress the evidence.
I found it in this blue trifolded envelope.
These defense lawyers are scumbags.
Well, I was curious about the history of a notary because, you know, all this stuff had to start somewhere. I assume that, you know, they didn't just invent it in a bank or something like that. So I figured it had to start somewhere. So I looked it up and it said, the practice of notary public dates back to ancient Roman times when few people were taught to read and write, you know, just like we talked about here in West Virginia.
Yeah.
And a notarius was appointed as a public official to create written documents of agreements or wills and hold them for safekeeping. Wax seals with individualized engravings or symbols were used as signatures at the end of the written agreements. In later centuries, ribbons were woven into multiple page documents to tie the pages together. Seals were placed over the knots to ensure no pages were added or removed. This was the birth of the notary seal and certificate.
It sounds a lot more intricate back then.
That's right. Around the globe today, there are three major distinctly different notarial systems, each associated with a different kind of notary. The civil law notary system of the Latin nations, the common law notary system of the English-speaking nations, and the notary system of the United States, which is derived from the English common law system, but quite different. Now, if you go back to ancient Egypt, like 2750 to 2250 BC, ancient Egyptian sesh or scribes were established in the Old Kingdom and were the earliest known chroniclers of official communications in recorded history. The tools of their craft were pigments, water pots, and writing implements, which they often carried over their shoulders. Scribes made up an entire level of ancient bureaucracy and were the only citizens who were aware of almost every noteworthy event in the empire. Personal letters, diplomatic communications, wills, and other legal documents, official proclamations, tax records, administrative, economic, and religious documents, and other documents all went through their hands. The closing phrase of their ancient letters, "May you be well when you hear this," implies that the scribes not only wrote, but also read communications between two people. The recording of events was so highly valued that Pharaoh Tutankhamun, you know, King Tut, he even included writing equipment among the necessities he had with him for the afterlife.
I heard he was buried in his jammies.
He was. Today, there are preserved, Steve Martin will tell you that. Today, there are preserved copies of the efforts of some scribal apprentices whose works have been corrected in red by their masters. Moving on up to the Roman Empire.
So the red correction is...
It dates way back to Egyptians where they would fix your school papers.
Yeah, I have some teachers that love that red pen.
I don't think it was the teachers. I think it was you.
I was using poetic license. They just didn't understand me.
In the Roman Empire in 535, the true ancestors of notaries were born in the Roman Empire. Many regard history's first notary to be a Roman slave named Tiro, who developed a shorthand system, which he called note, for taking down the speeches of the famed orator Cicero. Other witnessing stenographers came to be known as notarii and scribae. As literacy was not widespread, the notary or notarius, as they were called, served to prepare contracts, wills, and other important documents for a fee. As the Roman Empire grew and literacy increased, demand for the notary also increased.
Odore nay, this occument day.
Are you doing pig Latin? Pig Latin was different than the Roman Empire. That was more from Lord of the Flies. Next along came the Order of the Knights of Templar from 1099 to 1307. The Knights of Templar were a monastic military order formed at the end of the First Crusade with the mandate of protecting Christian pilgrims en route to the Holy Land. From humble beginnings, within two centuries, they had become powerful enough to defy all but the papal throne, and they created the modern system of banking, mortgages, and loans. The clergy of the order were highly educated and became the critically important notaries for all Templar business, official documents, orders, and proclamations. Now, then came notary publics in England in the 13th and 14th centuries. Notaries were not introduced into England until later in the 13th and 14th centuries as English common law developed separately from most of the influences of Roman law. Notaries were often appointed by the papal legate or the Archbishop of Canterbury, and in those early days, many were members of the clergy. Over the course of time, members of the clergy ceased to involve themselves in secular business. Thus, laymen in towns and trading centers began to assume the official character and functions of the modern notary. Notaries and the conquests of Columbus. Notaries accompanied Columbus on all of his voyages to ensure King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella that all discovered treasures were accounted for. They witnessed noteworthy acts like when Columbus first beheld the New World in 1492 by landing on San Salvador Island in the Bahamas. So they didn't trust him.
Yeah.
They wanted to make sure that anything he found made it back to them because they were financing this trip. And they also wanted to make sure that anything he claimed that he found land-wise, there was somebody there to witness that. So they sent notaries along.
Somebody who's trustworthy.
Yeah. Notaries in early America, 1600 to 1800. In colonial America, only persons of high moral character were appointed as public notaries to certify and keep documents safe. Their contributions to colonial life are largely seen as the reason American business became a huge success. For example, in colonial time, notaries were invaluable to transatlantic commerce, as parties on both sides depended on them to be honest third parties in reporting damage or loss to a ship's cargo. While notaries were held in very high regard during this time, life for notaries in early America was anything but easy. Some were even killed for their involvement in authenticating official documents and record keeping as conflicting factions fought for control of the New World.
Offered us $5.
Yeah, for $5 to verify the load was damaged, and then you're going to get killed because the other guy didn't like it. You know how longshoremen are.
I think you might be entitled to a slightly larger fee for doing that kind of work.
Well, now, $5 back in them days was big money.
Probably true. You could go to a movie back then and still have money left over for popcorn and a drink and go to the arcade afterwards. Play pinball, because that's all he had.
That's right. Watch a movie. John Coolidge, the father of President Calvin Coolidge, was the first notary to swear in a president.
Really?
When his son was moved to president, when he was the vice president under Warren G. Harding, and Harding died while in office, so Coolidge was sworn in as the president, and his father did it. He was the only one to ever be sworn in by a notary.
Hmm.
Other fascinating historical facts. Now, this one I found very interesting. They had notaries of the bedchamber. That means in the Middle Ages, notaries...
I kind of know where you're going with this one.
Notaries were sometimes asked to witness the consummation of marriages involving royalty or members of the peerage. So they wanted to make sure that the wedding had been consummated, so these guys would sit there and watch and then write it down. I guess the time, okay, it took place at this event. Now, Robert Kraft probably didn't want a notary in there when his event was consummated.
I mean, I don't know. Is it worth $5?
You might have to pay $5 to get in. To be or not to be, there is considerable evidence that Shakespeare once worked for a Warwickshire notary and later had repeated contact with other English notaries. It is felt that he drew on these experiences to write such plays as The Merchant of Venice. Let's see. We talked about Columbus and how he had the ones along. And it said on October 12, 1492, when Columbus first beheld the New World, a notary named Rodrigo de Escambido was on hand to document the landing on San Salvador Island in the Bahamas. So that's his place in history. Papal notaries. Notaries were once church officials appointed by the Pope. After Henry VIII separated England from the Church of Rome, remember, because he couldn't divorce?
Right.
The Archbishop of Canterbury commissioned notaries in England and her American colonies. In colonial time, notaries were invaluable to transatlantic commerce. Like we talked about, they were the honest third party, and their notarial act was known as a marine protest. That was what they called when they would file those for cargo damage and stuff like that.
A marine protest?
A marine protest.
Hmm.
Now, unfortunately for the history of America, the very first American notary was a forger. The American colony's first notary, a guy named Thomas Fugel, who will live forever in infamy, was appointed in 1639 in the New Haven colony. He miserably failed to live up to his duties and was thrown out of office for falsifying documents.
That's the one job you had, Mr. Fugel.
And he screwed it up. I thought this was interesting. With the purchase of Louisiana in 1803, an outpost of the French legal system was absorbed into the United States, because, of course, Louisiana was, at that time, a French territory. To this day, Louisiana's legal system and its notaries are unique, modeled in large part on the Napoleonic Code, and Louisiana notaries have powers similar to those of attorneys.
Huh.
So some in at least one state, then you do kind of find all lawyers are notaries.
Yeah, it kind of links up a little bit.
At the turn of the century, the power of appointing notaries for the District of Columbia was still delegated to the President of the United States.
Really?
The President appointed notaries.
Up until when?
To the turn of the century.
Hmm.
Well, I would assume that was, you know, 1900s.
Probably.
Yeah, not the 2000s. Notaries were appointed for a 5-year term and removed at the President's discretion. Today, the mayor of the district appoints its notaries.
Hmm. That's now, interesting.
Not only could women not vote, but until the early 1900s, women in America were also prohibited from becoming notaries. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. held that since there was no record of women holding the office in England, it could not be affirmed that women were capable of being notaries. Today, more than 2/3 of America's notaries are women. Can you believe that?
That makes no sense.
There's a poor ruling by a Supreme Court justice, huh?
Oh, there's plenty of them. Like the one about the Alabama inmate.
Yeah. At one time in Tennessee, statutes forbade known duelists from becoming notaries because they were considered individuals of questionable reputation. In South Carolina, a 127-year-old law requires all notary applicants to swear allegiance to God. In a case currently before the state Supreme Court, an atheist is challenging this requirement. Artist inventor Leonardo da Vinci was also the son of a notary. To safeguard his ideas, da Vinci perfected the skill of writing backwards. One must use a mirror to read his thoughts. So it says it's a good thing he didn't follow in his father's footsteps, because that wouldn't have worked, writing backwards in that. And then also another famous person was a notary. In 1864, Samuel Clemens, otherwise known as Mark Twain, became a notary public in Nevada, the only genuine public office to which he was ever appointed. The literary world is ever grateful he chose not to remain in public service. So that's just a little history on notaries, notary, how it developed, and some of the people that were notaries and what the influence was and stuff. I always find that kind of stuff very interesting.
The history or the trivia.
Yeah, that's right. You never know when something like that might pop up in a bar trivia, and there you go. You learn something from Court Appointed.
Well, that's going to bring us to
Legal Briefs.
So Legal Briefs is a part of the show where we ask different legal terms. And this one I thought would be kind of interesting to ask you, Tommy. How do you become a notary in West Virginia?
Well, you have to apply for it. And you have to...
Let me ask you this. Are you qualified?
I don't know. I'm of dubious character, so I'm probably not qualified. I'm a known liar, so... I don't think I could.
Fortunately for you, that's not one of the requirements. You have to be 18 years old.
Well, I'm barely there.
Let's get real here. Be a citizen or permanent legal resident of the U.S. and West Virginia.
I am that.
Be able to read and write English.
I can mostly do that.
You can make your mark.
Yeah.
Have a high school diploma or its equivalent.
I got that.
You graduate from the same high school.
Yeah.
Huntington East. Woo! Go Highlanders. And not have conviction or felony for any crime involving fraud, dishonesty, deceit.
Well, no, they never caught me.
So there you go. So you are qualified.
I was never convicted.
So basically, what would you have to do if you wanted to be a notary?
I just need to fill out the papers and get somebody to swear to it and send it in with $5.
It costs more than $5, I'm pretty sure.
I don't need a bond.
No, you don't need a bond. Do you have to take a test in West Virginia?
No.
Do you have to take a test in some places?
Yes. Florida, you had to take a test.
That's right. And
you'd take an online course and a test.
What's the most important thing you need to be a notary?
A stamp.
That's true.
If you don't have the stamp, you can't notarize nothing.
And remember what the stamp has to have on it?
It has to have your name, that you're a notary public from the state of West Virginia, and that you have when your termination date is.
Expiration date.
Expiration date.
That's right. I think you are actually qualified to be a notary in West Virginia.
Well, that's true. That conviction didn't go through, so I'm all right. I am still a person of questionable reputation, though.
Yeah, but I'll vouch for you.
Well, thanks. I got a lawyer to vouch for me. And all lawyers are notaries, so that's good.
Well, you know, I mean, it doesn't make... I think if you are a lawyer, you should probably go ahead and just get to be a notary by de facto. Because, I mean, if somebody has to go through the rigors of becoming a lawyer, don't they kind of probably meet the same criteria, if not more, than... that of being a notary?
Well, you would hope so.
One would hope.
But the other thing I would think is it's just a convenience thing. If not you, then your secretary or clerk or whatever, because think of all the legal documents you're going through that will have to be notarized, and then you'd have to stop and go get them notarized all the time. Whereas if you could do it, you could just do it right there in your office, and you don't have to worry about going somewhere else.
It is kind of a convenience thing. Since I'm not a notary anymore, it's been a bit more of a pain to have to get somebody to come down and notarize something.
But you all probably have ones in your office, don't you?
Oh, yeah, we do.
Yeah, so that's one thing. If you're in a larger firm and you've got one available in your firm, then that makes it all right.
Well, there's like three or four, but I mean, there's times when somebody's out sick or somebody has to go to the doctor or somebody has to be out of the office and it's lunchtime. I took their lunch late and you're kind of like, well, there's no notaries here right now.
Well, I think that notaries shouldn't be allowed to eat lunch. They should have to be on duty and ever vigilant.
I don't think that's one of the things specified in the code.
That's how you can tell a notary they're all skinny where they skipped lunch.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable Podcast for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you like us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out, though, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.